This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritson. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Smee.
Good evening, everyone. We have a guest that we had on previously, but he wasn't able to make it. And Dan Vega. Danny Vega, how you doing, buddy?
Steve, good, man. Absolutely butchered that interview. Okay. We were supposed to get Danny on last week. Danny had some extremely unfortunate news. Danny's son was actually hit by a truck. Yeah. I mean, I've had guests cancel before, but I've never had a guest have to reschedule for such a horrible circumstance. So joining us today is Danny Vega. He's one of the hosts of the Ketogenic Athlete podcast. Danny, thank you for coming on the show. No worries about having to reschedule. How's your son doing, man? Like, I'm not a father. I couldn't even believe what's going through your head right now.
Man, honestly, it's going to be 2 weeks tomorrow. I can't believe it's been almost 2 weeks. It feels like it was just yesterday. My 4-year-old is 100%. He's basically completely normal. I mean, it's a miracle. He obviously, the day that it happened, a bunch of stuff happened, you know, like his face was all ripped up and his ear was basically almost completely torn off and exposed, and I saw cartilage. It was just blood everywhere. I mean, I cannot put into words. If you're a parent and you're listening, you'll understand. Like, I don't have to explain it much, you know, just the thought of your child being hit by a truck and you getting that call is just, but you know, I just can't. I got nauseous talking about it for the first week and a half or so, and now I'm just like at a point where, because I'm playing with him every day, and like my son is like as if nothing happened, you know. And I'm like, well, if he's 4 and he can move on, I think it's time for me to move on and just, you know, focus on how grateful I am for obviously him being alive. And of course our family is stronger because of it, but it was, it's just, you don't wake up and think today my son's going to get hit by a truck. You just don't. It's not usually in your expectations for the day.
So what exactly caused that to happen? Was it just an accident or what?
Man, it was like a perfect storm of things. You know, he and my other son, my 7-year-old, my oldest, were with the nanny, and my wife was at home, and my wife was actually waiting for me and another friend of mine who were getting home. So we were 5 minutes away no matter what. And we were going to record a podcast because I have the Ketogenic Athlete, but I'm starting another podcast with my wife. It's kind of the Fat Fueled Family podcast. So it's kind of going to be like how we do keto and nutrition. We do keto and paleo with the boys, you know, but kind of everything we do as a family, we're very unconventional. We do peaceful parenting and we're unschoolers and all this other stuff. So I get this call from my wife who's running and screaming as she's calling me that they hit my 4-year-old. Someone hit my son with a car, you know, a truck hit him. And so without getting too much into the details, basically my oldest always looks both ways and tells my other son to, you know, that it's okay to cross. And Desmond, the oldest, was on his little scooter thing, and Dean was on his little Ziggle scooter thing, which is low to the ground. And you kind of like, you move the handlebars and it propels you forward. And as Desmond tells him it's okay, there's a truck pulling out of a parking space that is by the mailboxes, because they're about to cross that last little street in my neighborhood, in the front of my neighborhood, to go to the pool. So there's a sidewalk and crosswalk. It connects to crosswalks and you cut across the whole neighborhood. And everybody uses it. We use it all the time to go to the pool. And that front street, there's, you know, so basically between the truck driver, you know, hitting him, and there was no speed bump or anything, which obviously now we're advocating for speed bumps and things like that in our neighborhood. You know, I got that call, and then I got to the scene and he was already gone. He was on the way to the hospital. And so I got to see him for the first time in the hospital. And like I said, long story short, man, just it's just a miracle that he, no internal organs, nothing with his internal organs, his skull, his brain, his spinal cord. He just now, he's in a neck brace for a month because he has some torn ligaments in his cervical spine. So, I mean, all things considered, I'll take it, you know?
Danny, one of my best friends is a chiropractor.
Oh, yeah, you sent me that. I remember that, yeah.
He was really, really worried about your son's spine. Do you currently see a chiropractor?
We don't, but I, you know, there was so much going on when you sent me that email, and, you know, it's definitely something that I think, you know, he could benefit from. I've used chiropractors before a ton. I use massage therapists as well. I use a lot of that stuff today. I got a massage today, so definitely a believer in that stuff.
Definitely contact Dr. Zoltan. He'll put you in contact with someone good in your area. Because if you have it, like, even if his spine seems straight and, like, he seems, like, okay, if a nerve is pinched, it can prevent him from, you know, developing properly, his brain developing properly. So it's But anyways, that's in the past. Luckily, your son's okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself. We just had the Perfect Keto Guys on our podcast. They spoke extremely highly of you. I checked out your podcast. You're talking about some really cool stuff, stuff no one's talking about. I mean, you got a thing on your shoulder that's constantly measuring your blood glucose. You're like a really weird guy, but a really definitely good guy at the same time. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, what are your credentials? What got you into this whole ketogenic world?
Yeah, so I was an athlete my whole life. I played football and I ran track, and then got recruited to play football at Columbia University in New York City and played up there. And then got my master's. I was kind of like the teacher's pet in the weight room. You know, I was like, My strength coach was my favorite coach of all the football coaches. You know, I was always a fan of strength, you know, and strength and conditioning and lifting and stuff. And so he ended up leaving after my sophomore year, and I was real beat up about it. But I kept in touch with him, and I basically told him, I called him when I was going to grad school, that I'm going to become a strength and conditioning coach. And he was just very surprised by it, because he's like, you're this Cuban kid from Miami. Your parents, you know, my dad didn't graduate from high school. My dad dropped out of high school. My mom didn't go to college. And here I go to an Ivy League school and I tell him I want to be a coach. So I go to grad school at UF and I was a grad assistant in the weight room for football for the first 5 months until they moved me to the basketball facility, where I started to get paid there. I had a lot more responsibility. So I spent most of my 2 years with the basketball team, and that's what led to me getting the job at VCU in Richmond, Virginia. I was the head strength and conditioning coach for them, for the basketball team, and I went with the assistant head coach, who became the coach there, the assistant head coach of UF. And we completely changed the way they did everything. So we had the best record in school history, conference history. They wrote you know, an article about my training methods, how I kind of changed a few things with the training. It was a lot more comprehensive when I got there. And so I've always been into strength and conditioning, and I never was like a low carb person per se. I was always pretty much the standard, you know, athletic type of, you know, high carbohydrate diet. And in 2013, I started powerlifting. Before that, there was like a 2 to 3 year period where I was doing CrossFit. So it was like automatic paleo, you know, that's kind of like the thing. And I did really well with paleo. But then with, you know, powerlifting, the whole culture is, you know, centered around carbs and everything. So, so I did that for a few years, and then I had a few injuries that caused me to pull out of one meet, and I was just reevaluating things. And I started to cut, and I did like a bodybuilding style cut with a bodybuilder friend of mine. So I had really low fat. And several months of that, got really lean, and then was just miserable. And I had a friend who kept telling me about this keto thing, and I thought it was absurd. But, you know, in June of 2016, after several months of being, you know, on a typical low fat diet, I was at the point where I was low carb and low fat. So when I switched to keto, I automatically felt amazing because I added fat back. And so from the beginning, I noticed all these benefits, you know, anti-inflammatory benefits. You know, my brain was better than ever, just an increase in productivity. And I think one of the biggest ones for me is being that I've eaten really, really fast, and I've been obsessed with eating a lot since I was young to put on size. And so I feel like that definitely did something to my hunger hormones and just all that. And so my appetite's always been an issue, and keto's really been the best thing for my appetite. So I obviously am a big fan of it. I can't say for sure that I'm going to be keto for the rest of my life, but I think I'm pretty sure that I'll be low carb at least for the rest of my life, or keto. And, you know, for the most part of it, also even mostly carnivore, which is just meat. So I obviously, as everything that I do, I'm a little bit obsessive. And so I got involved with keto pretty early on because I was just doing so much research. And 2 months into it, after reading, like, you know, dozens and dozens of published papers and several books, I reached out to a guy who had a podcast here called Keto Evangelist. And I told him, hey, if you ever want to do anything with athletes, let me know. I didn't know that he was starting an athlete podcast, and he had me on as a guest, and we just kind of hit it off, man. And so after that, it was basically like literally right after that interview that he did with me, he says, you need to be my co-host. So that was in August of 2016. And obviously 2 years later, I think I've built a name for myself as someone who, like, you see this continuous blood glucose monitor. I do a lot of self-experimentation, and I like to share that with everyone. And I'm just focused on looking at not only how ketogenic diets may be able to help athletes, whether it be in their sport or in the off season, like whether it be used as a tool for a short period of time, or maybe for someone who wants to use it, you know, for good. And then I also like to help educate a lot of people who are new to diets. Because what I find, you guys will probably agree with this, like, it's, I always make this analogy. It's kind of like the person who has never worked out in their life and says, you know, all of a sudden they find CrossFit and CrossFit works great for them. And then they think CrossFit's like the only thing, you know, and it's like nothing. If it's not CrossFit, it's not good. And then, like, I find a lot of people do the same thing with keto, you know, these people who've never looked into nutrition their whole life, you know, and they don't do, they do very well with keto, and they think that keto is the only thing. And I think it's dangerous to think that, you know, you've arrived and you've kind of found all the answers. So I'm trying to, what I do with my platform is really try to encourage people to, like, think about things, individualize them for themselves. And obviously don't just do what I do, but kind of find what works for you. So that's kind of like my whole deal.
Okay. So Danny, before we dig too much deep in this, you know, we get a lot of people on the forums always talking about keto, and it seems like to me, a lot of people, you know, want to get into keto, but they don't quite understand it. And I noticed that too, because you mentioned paleo, the paleo diet, and, you know, this CrossFit, people love to do it. But then you hear about them going to eat an Outback dinner, and they think that's paleo. Yeah, and I'm like, dude, you know, wouldn't paleo be someone, or they'll go buy a farm-raised salmon from the grocery store. And I'm like, dude, why don't you go catch your own fish? Isn't that what our ancestors, the cavemen, did? They actually went and caught their own food. They didn't go buy farm-raised stuff. So kind of define keto diet, because you mentioned it's a high meat diet, but, you know, if you're going to make a steak and make it keto, you can't go and drench it in canola oil and hydrogenated oils like they do in the restaurants. So, I mean, can you be more specific as to what is a keto diet? Does it include vegetables? Does it include other things? You know, go ahead, define it for us.
Yeah, I bet you, you know, if you ask several different people, they'll tell you several different things about what a ketogenic diet is. So I'll tell you kind of how I see it. First of all, like, if we're just going by the strictest definition, is a ketogenic diet is a diet where it's encouraging ketone production. So, you know, people start to talk about macronutrient ratios and all these things, and then I'm like, wait a second. You know, they say you can't have your protein too high, you can't have your fat too low, you can't have this. And in reality, if we're just strictly defining a ketogenic diet, it's really a diet in which carbohydrates are low enough for that person to basically signal the body to produce ketones. So if you ask me how I see keto, it's definitely evolved over the years. You know, originally the first year that I did keto, I did the typical more higher fat version of keto, where you're just adding tons of fat to everything and really moderating my protein. In 2017, I did this experiment when I cut the 6% body fat. And my protein, daily protein, was like 75 grams a day for like a month, you know, and it was under 100 for like 2 months. And interestingly, I you know, didn't lose any lean body mass. I actually was in a deficit and I gained 6 pounds of lean mass. That I didn't expect. But as I've kind of continued and tweaked stuff for myself, I am now much more higher protein, and I eat a much more carnivorous focused diet. So it's mostly meat. But if I were to say, okay, for someone who says, oh, tell me what the ketogenic diet is, I'll say, look, it's a diet where, you know, you're going to have to restrict carbohydrates enough to where you can signal keto, like, you know, basically encourage ketosis to happen. For a lot of people, that's anywhere from 50 to 75 grams a day or less. If you're smaller, it could be as low as 20 grams a day or less. But then I say, I think to me, it's more than just macronutrient ratios. To me, it's very important to be, because keto has started to become very commercialized. And so you're seeing a lot of products over there that we have here. And, you know, you guys are probably have the most similar product offerings as us. You know, people in Europe are dying because they wish they had what we had. But honestly, I think a lot of it is garbage. You know, it's just processed keto junk food that basically, you know, it checks the boxes, but it's not real food. So for me, I am very much focused on real food. You mentioned the vegetable oils. I absolutely agree, man. I really try to avoid eating out, honestly, as much as possible. There's so much crap in food in general besides the vegetable oils. But, you know, I was talking to a doctor friend of mine who's a very influential MD in the ketogenic space. And we were both like, I don't know what's more damaging, sugar or vegetable oils. We would argue possibly that vegetable oils are more damaging than sugar. So for me, it's like, it's real food. It's low carb. Is it high fat? Yes. But I don't think that, you know, if we're talking about the diet that we've, adapted to the best or the diet we were designed for, I just don't see that diet being a diet where we're putting extra butter and fat on everything. We're not, you know, I honestly, you know, if it's a high fat diet, that's a ketogenic diet to me. Finney and Volek, who are the people that we look to the most, are kind of like the OG keto people who were like, they went from like pariahs to like saviors, you know, in the past 30, 40 years. They have these suggestions, and we say suggestions because it's kind of like what they've observed with the athletes they've worked with, the patients they've had. And they'll say a ketogenic diet is a diet where your fat is anywhere from 65 to 80%. Usually protein is like anywhere from like 15 to 25%. And carbs are, you know, 5 to 10% of your total energy.
Danny, talk to us a little bit about carbohydrate refeeds. So when you say keto diet, are you doing that 7 days a week? Or are you implementing like a high carb day once a week, a cheat meal once a week, anything like that?
So I personally, being that I'm just such an addictive person, I just honestly, like, if I turn on that carb, you know, faucet, I don't know if I would be, I would be gone for a few days. And so what I, with a cyclic ketogenic diet, which is what you're talking about, where it's a refeed, it's a carb up or a cheat day. The current research is not good. It's, you know, not, it doesn't, it suggests that it's not good, but we only have research on 2 day refeeds. So in the one study that we have that we can reference, there were two groups of bodybuilders. Both of them were well trained, and they basically they were both in a deficit, and one group stayed strict ketogenic diet the whole time, and then the other group would do these refeeds 2 days a week. And what they found was that both groups lost the same amount of weight, but the group that was doing the refeeds actually lost mostly lean mass. And so they had some other issues where they would have cravings, and then they weren't back into ketosis, you know, for very long. So, but that being said, I'm not writing it off, but I would like to see some research on one meal carb ups or 1 day carb ups. I feel like 2 days is just so long to be out of ketosis that it's a little bit more counterproductive. I've recently done kind of some of my own experiments where I brought my carbs back up. And you guys, if you eat lots of carbs, you're gonna think it's a joke, but for me this is like a lot. Because I'm like, for the past year of my 2 years that I've been keto, I've been mostly carnivore, so basically mostly meat. So when I decided that I was going to add 50 carbs back in, that was like a big deal for me. And you know, for those, I did it for 5 days, 50 carbs, you know, all in one, on all in the post-workout meal. And, you know, I did, I had an increase in appetite, which is probably like from a slight increase in my RMR. So there was a little bit, you know, revving up my metabolism a little bit. I think for someone who's really trying to put on a lot of muscle, it might make some sense to do that. For me, it doesn't, because I'm already like as large as I want to be. But I will say that in the past 2 years, I've never had a cheat day or anything like that, but I did row 50,000 meters in April for charity. And so I spoke to one of my closest friends who's, he's not a keto guy. He obviously loves ketosis, but he's a fat metabolism guy. So he's the guy who's the expert in getting the best fat metabolism that we can get. And basically, if you're someone who's fat adapted and you eat low carbs and then you bring those carbs in, chances are those carbs are going to become like a PED. Like they're going to become like a performance enhancing drug, because it's exactly what happened to me. So I the night before, I had 280 carbs, felt pretty amazing. And I felt like I was waiting to see bad effects or what was going to happen. And just because I hadn't had carbs in so long, you know. I woke up the next morning with my blood glucose slightly elevated and my ketones were slightly down, but I did the first 37,000 meters fasted. And by the time I finished that first 37,000 meters, my blood glucose was back in the, you know, for you guys, like if you measure that in millimoles, it's like 4.4 or so. So probably like low 80s. Ketones were up, and then I had 80 more carbs. Then I did the last 13,000 meters. And after that, my ketones were at 4.4 and my blood glucose was 68, which is probably like 3-point-something millimoles. So I would definitely say that if it's someone who's already fat adapted, they can definitely play with it. But I would wait to do something like that until you're fat adapted. And how do you know you're fat adapted? There's no real objective measures. The things that I tell people to look for is when you feel like you're getting your pump back in the gym, when you feel like your workouts are back, when you feel like you can fast if you wanted to, like your energy and your brain is working. And for a lot of people, that's 2 to 3 months. So I definitely think, like I said, you could, I would still not try to do like a crazy high carb day, but I think it does make sense if you wanted to like top off your glycogen levels and restore your glycogen levels a little bit, or if you're feeling run down, which is kind of how I plan on doing it in the future. Like if I do those days where I have 50 to 100 carbs, it'll be like when I had a really strong leg day the day before and I feel kind of run down, and I'll do it.
Danny, are the majority of listeners of your podcast, are they natural or are they using performance enhancing drugs?
I would say my audience is mostly natural, but you know, the audience of a lot of the friends that I have is definitely using stuff, because you know, I run in powerlifting circles and you know, bodybuilding circles, so a lot of the people are using performance enhancing drugs, and they've asked about that, you know. And I would say that if you are using performance enhancing drugs, you know, I don't see anything wrong with doing keto with that, unless you're you know, you're using like insulin and stuff, and then that's just the whole, I don't even know, I wouldn't even know how.
The reason I ask that is carbs are not essential, but they're a good performance aid. It's like you said, they're almost like a performance enhancing drug. Like yeah, there's essential amino acids, there's essential fatty acids, but carbs actually aren't needed. But saying carbs are useless, that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like, as you know, as a bodybuilder, they're good for glycogen. They keep the muscle full. They stimulate hard training. So one thing I've been experimenting with a lot of my clients is I'll have them on, you know, a keto diet the majority of the time. It's very individual. Some will be 5 days a week, 6 days a week. But when I switch it and I get them on a high carb, low fat refeed day, I'll get them on insulin, metformin, GDA supplements. And the next day they're back in ketosis.
Oh, I don't doubt that. And how high do you go with the carbs?
Again, it's like individual, but like 3 grams per pound of body weight for some of them.
Oh, wow. That's high. It's and high, then what's right? The fat, like really low, like what, like 50?
Extremely low, like trace.
Okay. But yeah.
The thing is, like if you're on keto and you're fat adapted, your glycogen levels are going to be pretty minimal. Like you're always going to have a little bit, right?
Yep.
But So then when you add in the insulin and the metformin and the GDAs, you almost become like a sponge to the carbs and you stay in ketosis because your glycogen levels are completely depleted. You pump in the carbs, you pump in all the GDAs and everything, your body soaks it up, and the next day you're still in ketosis. And another really good, like, again, like if you're a physique athlete and you care about, you know, how you look on stage and, you know, you want carbs for carb loading to make your muscles full. If you get your body fat adapted and then you add in the carbs, and especially if you also add in things like insulin and metformin, your body will soak up those carbs like a sponge, and then you won't get any water retention. There's a big problem with carbs come water. So a lot of times someone will, you know, go on a crazy cheat meal, pound like 1,000 grams of carbs, but then they look like a water buffalo.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if they're, you know, ingesting with fat as well, that's that just completely blows it away, you know, and it's not going into the muscles, it's going into the liver, and it's not going to the right place. So I can see that.
So like what I've been experimenting with is I'll start them off at, you know, 1 gram per pound of carb per body weight. Do that for a day. The next day, let's test your blood glucose fasted. If it's below 100, it's like, okay, next week, let's try 1.5 grams. Next, if it's still below 100, next week, let's try 2 grams. If it's still below 100, keep going. I find that most big guys can get up to about 3 to 3.5 grams of carbs per pound of body weight one day per week, and they'll stay in ketosis.
That's a really good way to test insulin sensitivity because, like you said, if they're continually doing this only once a week and they're when they do have this big bolus of carbs, they come back in and it's not lingering the next morning. Or something you could also add would be, you know, some people might have an elevated morning blood sugar just for other reasons that maybe it's related to stress. I find that if someone has a high fasted blood glucose, I'll also have them do a baseline test before they eat, and then do a test, you know, 1 hour postprandial and 2 hour postprandial. And I would say even if that person did have a little bit more elevated fasted glucose, but they're coming back to baseline within 2 hours of eating, then I would say they're still insulin sensitive, and that would still be possibly a good amount of carbs to do on a refeed, you know?
So tell us a little bit about you, Danny, on all this talk. What's a typical day like you in terms of what time you eat your first meal and what are you usually eating?
Yeah. Yeah. My days are really, really similar. I love, you know, kind of just the idea of being consistent. It's one of those things that, like, I don't know if you guys know Jocko Willink. He's a big Navy SEAL down here. He's written a bunch of books, and he has a picture of his watch every single morning at 4:30 a.m. And he's done that forever, for years. And he's always kind of like up at that time. And I'm the same way. I wake up at 4 a.m. every single day. On the weekends, I might sleep in until 5 or 5:30. And it's not because I'm this crazy, you know, hard ass. I've just accustomed my body to getting up that early. And I like how productive I am, especially speaking about kids, having those couple of hours alone to do my morning routine and everything before the kids is really important for me. So I wake up at 4 a.m. I start my day with some meditation, and I have this whole morning routine. And after I'm done with that, I'll have my first quote unquote meal, which I have like just a cup of coffee, probably like 12 to 16 ounces of coffee with like a tablespoon of MCT oil and some adaptogenic mushrooms that I add, you know, and maybe some unsweetened almond milk. And then I'll either 3 days a week, I'll do yoga before I lift, which people are like, what? You're crazy. You're doing yoga before you lift. See, for me, it doesn't matter. My output doesn't really matter like it did before, where I'm not. So I kind of see it as like a way to just get stronger mentally, where I'm done with yoga and now I got to lift. So I'll lift at 7 a.m. Like I said, 3 days a week, I'll do yoga for an hour before I lift. And then I probably won't eat my first solid meal until about 10 to 10:30 a.m. And so that meal is always an avocado with like 16 to 20 ounces of meat, where it's either going to be grass-fed bison, grass-fed, you know, any type of ruminant meat. Like I love, you know, I do mostly ruminant meat. So like the lamb, the bison, the cow, you know, grass-fed cow. I had for dinner, I had venison. So I call them my keto muscle bowl. So it's always like a bunch of meat and avocado, you know, for the electrolytes and, you know, the good stuff in the avocado.
Let me stop you right there, Danny, 1 second.
Yeah.
You live in South Florida, right?
Yep.
Okay. So where are you getting this grass-fed beef and all this stuff?
So I have a few places. I have a local farm here that I get from, Oliver Heritage Farms that I get. And then I also have Butcher Box. I don't know if you guys know.
Okay. So you recommend guys either find like a Whole Foods or like a local farmer to get this stuff, because that's crucial.
Getting local grass-fed for me. Beef. Yeah, local for me is the best. It's always going to be the best, especially because you're going to be able to talk to the person. And, you know, I know exactly what the chickens are eating. Like, he'll say, hey, look, I changed things up a little bit because, you know, certain chickens, just the chickens, for instance, like they have preferences, you know, like, so they don't, you supplement them sometimes with certain things because they may not have enough grubs, but or, you know, little critters to eat. But like I said, it's the best is definitely going local. And if not, go with there's one in Canada. I forget the name that ButcherBox recommends. I forget the name of it. But I do buy from ButcherBox, which is grass finished. And I buy from U.S. Wellness Meats. Both of those two places are where I get my meat. I will say when it comes to the subject of meat, my biggest concern is not with grass-fed, believe it or not. I know it might sound controversial. My concern is more with if it's organic. So if it's someone that doesn't have a lot of money and can't pay that extra little premium for the grass-fed, I would argue that they can, but that's another subject. What I say is go for organic, because if we're talking about grass-fed versus grain-fed from a fatty acid profile, I'm just not convinced that there's enough difference, because like what you'll see is like probably 10% of that meat is polyunsaturated fat, right? The rest of it is mostly saturated fat. And so if there's a much higher percentage, which I would agree that there is a much higher percentage of omega-3s in the grass-fed beef, but it's really only 10% of the fat, I don't think that's going to be a deal breaker. What really concerns me and why I say get organic at least is because of like just all the spraying and all the just crap that they put in the feed that these animals are getting. So that's just a personal thing for me. Like I'm going to go for the best of the best, but if people are trying to see like what they can do, I would say at least get organic.
You know what though, Danny? Okay. So I agree with you. There's the three categories of fats, right? You have your polyunsaturates, monounsaturates, and your saturates. Red meat is going to be primarily monounsaturated and saturated.
Yep.
Polyunsaturates, there's not a whole lot of it in red meat. So when it says that grass-fed beef has more omega-3s, well, there's not much omega-3s at all. So I agree with you there. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the saturated fat content of grass-fed beef versus grain-fed, the saturated fat content of grass-fed beef is more short and medium-chain fatty acids, so more things like that are naturally found in coconut. So it's actually a lot less inflammatory than grain-fed beef.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. And that makes sense, because there are studies, and like for instance, I saw one where they compared monounsaturated fat diet, heavy diet versus a saturated fat diet, and the saturated fat was much more inflammatory, you know, lots of the inflammatory markers and things like that. And I was just like dying to see what the hell they fed these people. Because I'm like, okay, if this is a saturated fat plus, you know, grains diet, I would say that there would be a difference there. There's also the stuff that's going on now. I'm sure you've seen all the research that people are doing now with endotoxins and, you know, like the, you know, LPS, and how higher fat diets may play a role in, you know, triggering these endotoxins, which I'm obviously very concerned about. And I, for me, one of my biggest things, I've been doing a lot of research into glycine. I don't know if you guys, have researched into it, but man, I'm really liking this thing for like a lot of reasons. One of them is for that.
You mean the amino acid glycine?
Yeah. Yeah. Glycine is like, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's been used for, diabetics, you know, for blood sugar control. It's been used in really high doses as an antipsychotic. But it also has been shown in several studies to protect the liver, protect the kidney, a few other really interesting things that So for me, I actually this week started to play around with, especially since I got this continuous blood glucose monitor on, to see kind of what this glycine supplementation does for blood sugar. And the other thing is that as humans, we have this glaring glycine deficit that we've had for generations and generations because it doesn't affect reproduction. It doesn't affect a whole bunch of stuff. But if we can supplement, we can possibly, you know, help ourselves in several ways. So I'm a fan of that. I know I kind of went on a tangent there, but
do you know another thing that glycine is involved in, which makes it super important?
Let's see what it
collagen synthesis.
Oh yeah, so that's why collagen has a bunch of glycine in it. So you know, one of the best ways you can get glycine is with collagen.
Well, what's fascinating about collagen is it's the most abundant protein in the human body, right? Your hair, your skin, your teeth, the entire lining of your cardiovascular system, it's all collagen. You would think it would be this super complex protein. It's 3 amino acids.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And people don't get enough collagen. People don't, because we don't eat nose to tail. So, you know, collagen's now, I think, getting a little bit more popular. I don't know if it's getting popular in Canada, but down here.
Are you consuming bone broth?
I do. We do most of our collagen from homemade bone broth. So we got always something going right now. Like right now we're out. So we ordered a bunch of bones from US Wellness. So we're getting those. I have these ribs that, these pork ribs that I want my wife to throw in there. She's like, I've never seen, you know, bone broth with pork. I'm like, what's the hurt? You know, it's got to have something in it. So I'm like, throw them in there. But yeah, we mostly do it from there. We also have a few brands that we like, that have like grass fed, collagen and gelatin and stuff.
Yeah. I make bone broth once a week, two days in the, slow cooker. And, it's really made a difference in my health as well. So is your, the rest of your day diet, how many more meals are you eating besides that one at 10:30?
So typically I'll have one more big meal. That's about it. I'm not really
hungry. You're supposed to eat 10 times a day. Rich Piana says you got to eat 10 times a day. Got to have chicken, rice, and broccoli. That's what all the diet coaches teach guys.
You know,
dead. So it's probably not the best advice.
Huh?
He's also dead. Yeah.
Yeah. But every personal trainer tells the clients, you got to eat 8 meals a day. That's what I used to do, and I just got fat. So I only eat 2 or 3 meals a day too. So
that used to be me, man. I would pack when we would go to the parks like Disney World and stuff. I would have like 4 meals, and I had the plan was to consume the first one at 10:30, the second one at 1, and the third one like at, you know, 3 or 4. Well, what would happen is I'd probably have the first one at 9:30, the second one like at 10:30, and then the third one like at 1, and I'm dying like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know? So you have these like little insulin, your insulin's kind of like always elevated. You have these insulin spikes, and we know that, I think honestly, that hyperinsulinemia is probably the biggest threat because it's a driver of all these different diseases, you know? And so we have all these insulin spikes that are happening over time, and insulin resistance, you can have insulin resistance for 15 to 20 years before your blood glucose starts being elevated. So I think it's dangerous to be doing that. At least personally for me, 2 meals is more than enough. Sometimes it's 3 meals, but I just feel good that way. So I just have that second meal like at 6 p.m. So today it was a pound of ground venison with, I threw some goat cheese in there and some spices, and that was it. That was my meal.
I take it you're a fan of Jason Fung's books.
I haven't read his books, but okay. You know, I kind of,
if you do, you'll agree with exactly that. And that's,
fasting as his main way to cure kidney disease.
I actually, my blood glucose was 126, 3 years ago because I was doing that bullshit. Eight meals a day bullshit. And eat as soon as you get up, 7 o'clock, and eat every 2 hours. Because I believe that bullshit, because that's what everyone says to do.
We all do. We all
and
do.
Now my blood glucose is 69. I intermittent fast every day. So that's great, I do twice a day. So
Okay. I want to say something though.
Trevor doesn't agree, but
Okay. I agree with what you guys are saying. I agree that the human body is not designed to be pumping out insulin 6, 7, 8 times a day. And when you're eating, you know, six meals of chicken and rice, you're burning out your pancreas. But that being said, if you're a bodybuilder, if you're looking for someone to build mass, you do need a lot of calories. You do need some protein intake. Trying to get all your calories into two meals is going to be flat out miserable.
It's going
to
be.
Yeah, but Trevor, my counter to that is what the guy we just had on last week, I asked them, do you have any professionals in your family? He said, yeah, my brother plays for the Minnesota Vikings. Unless you have fantastic genetics, you will not be a professional bodybuilder. I don't care how much food you eat. You can eat 20 meals a day. Huh? So you don't need genetics to be a Mr. Olympia?
No, to be Mr. Olympia, well, duh. But to become a professional bodybuilder, no, you don't need it. You can,
okay, but I mean, to be at that level, like the 99 percentile of us, if we eat what Ronnie Coleman eats every day, we're just going to get fat.
I'm not saying eat what Ronnie Coleman eats. Let me finish. So what I'm saying is, if you're trying to be a bodybuilder, if you're trying to be, you know, a big guy with a lot of muscle, you need a lot of calories. You need a lot of protein. Trying to get that all in two meals is just, it's not feasible. So what I would do is eat four meals per day that are protein and fat. And then before your workout and after your workout, do protein and carbs. Include carbs, but be smart about them. Because it's like you said, carbs are like a performance-enhancing drug. Yep. When do you want carbs? When do you need carbs? Before exercise and after exercise. If you're working out after breakfast, do you need carbs at 8 p.m.? No, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
And I can tell you from training hundreds of people that if you're smart about your carb intake, and that means just including carbs pre-workout and post-workout, maybe just including carbs post-workout, like still having carbs, but the rest of the day doing protein and fat, you can stay in healthy blood glucose levels.
No, yeah. I don't disagree with that, but I'm saying most diet coaches and most personal trainers tell people to eat, you gotta eat six meals a day and you have two protein shakes. And that's just wrong. I mean, that doesn't work, you know?
I totally agree with that. I mean, I'll say that there's a lot of people in that camp who think that's the only way, and that's unfortunate. But then there's a lot of people in my camp who are the same way. They're just like, you know, they have people who may have had some initial success. Maybe they've been doing keto for like 2-3 years. They had this initial success and then they haven't changed much at all. And then they're just pounding the same thing. And it's like, if you only rely on reducing one macronutrient and that's the only thing that you ever do, what other triggers are you going to pull? You're not going to have anything. So, okay, the carbs are gone. What are we going to do now? So like, I just, you know, I'm just playing devil's advocate because I think that, and going back to our conversation about the cyclic versus the typical keto, I am actually a much bigger fan of like a targeted keto than I would be with a cyclical keto, because for that very reason, like if you're in a situation where, especially if you're training in that glycolytic pathway a lot, where you're doing lots of high volume, because I can put muscle on with keto but I cannot train like a high carb bodybuilder trains. If I did, I would just run myself into the ground. So I have to focus a little bit more. I can get into that glycolytic pathway a little bit, but I can't be, because I don't have instant carbs that I can take pre-workout, intro workout, and post-workout. So for that reason, my training has to reflect that. That being said, there's a lot of people that are just not healthy and they need to, you know, reverse their insulin resistance. And if it means being keto for several months and then all of a sudden their health markers are back and they're like lean, then, you know, I would say as long as they're smart with it, they can have some carbs in there and they can be strategic about it. Especially, I like what you're saying, you know, lifting in the morning, you know, there's no need for carbs in the rest of the day. I can guarantee you that if there's someone like myself that weighs like 230 pounds, with around 10 to 12% body fat, they can have, you know, over 100-150 carbs and it's all done by the morning, and they effectively don't eat carbs the rest of the day and they eat protein and fat, they'll be in ketosis the next morning. So, you know, that's definitely a good approach to have. Then you have people like my wife. You know, my wife is a carnivore. She's more hardcore carnivore than I am because she cannot tolerate a lot of plant foods. You know, she's done MRT panels. She's done everything. We've, you know, kind of done all the tests and paid lots of money to see what works best for her. And, you know, for her. And there's other people like that. I don't know if you guys know Michaela Peterson, Jordan Peterson's daughter. She eats like a carnivorous diet. She had lots of autoimmune things her whole life. And she can only do well with eating meat. You know, there's certain people that do well with that only, or there are people who they wouldn't, the carbs would probably never be an option because they either have some sort of neurodegenerative disease or some sort of other thing that benefit that ketosis would benefit them. But I agree that, you know, carbs definitely are not the devil, you know, on their own. It's just kind of, it's a combination of things, you know.
I'll let Trevor finish up the show, but I got to get to this. This is very important because the insulin guest we had before that Trevor mentioned, I asked her three times about what foods, you know, cause blood sugar spikes, and she couldn't give me an answer, you know, and I asked her, what resources can you give us that we can look this up? So you have a little toy on your shoulder. How does that work? Because I would love to get me one of those, as long as it doesn't involve pricking my shoulder. So how does that work, number one? And number two, what are some foods that are spiking blood sugar that we would not expect that you have found?
Okay, because I'll go into that. I just want you to know that there's a lot of things that are not going to spike blood sugar, but they're going to spike insulin, which to me is more of a concern. But so this little continuous blood glucose monitor is called a Dexcom. It's connected to the Dexcom app on my phone, and basically it continuously is giving readings to the app and telling me what my blood glucose is throughout the day. I've only had it for one day, but I've learned a lot because I'm used to taking like fasted glucose readings, and I'm used to doing different experiments with, like, you know, postprandial blood sugar. So measuring after trying something new at different intervals.
How does it work though? Like, is it not getting blood from your, I don't get it.
So it is a prick. So you're going to have to prick your shoulder, and then it's kind of stuck in.
Well, so you prick it and just tape it there?
Yeah. And it's stuck there. And then the actual device goes into the sensor, and these sensors last anywhere from, you know, 2 weeks to a month, depending on the person. Sometimes once it starts giving you question marks, like, and those, you know, continued question mark things, like it's not getting a good reading, then it's probably time to change it.
How much does it cost, and where can I get it? And I'll let you continue. I'll let Trevor finish up. I gotta know this because I'm curious to get.
Man, I'm so sorry that I cannot answer that. I'm just very fortunate that I had one of my followers send it to me.
Oh, okay.
So, like, I know that you need a script for it, and I hear that it's a little bit expensive. But the Freestyle Libre from Abbott Labs, I believe, it's the same company that makes their actual blood glucose monitor. I forget the name of that blood glucose monitor, but they have one that is apparently cheaper. This Dexcom is pretty cool. It's I got all types of metrics that it's giving me and graphs and all these cool things. I have found, crazy enough, maybe because I don't have foods that trigger blood sugar spikes, because I don't really eat a lot of carbs.
So what triggers insulin then? Let's go with that.
So there are certain sweeteners, for instance, that, you know, they'll be at the conventions and they'll be like, check it out, you can have our thing, and you're not look at your blood glucose, and your blood glucose is just, there's no change in blood glucose maybe 30 minutes, an hour later. What you might see is maybe like an hour to hour and a half post after that, is that you might see a drop in blood glucose. And that's because some of these are possibly triggering insulin, because a lot of the time the body may sense that this is something sweet. So it's like, okay, time to shuttle these carbs into the cells, and there's no carbs. So all of a sudden blood sugar goes down because insulin went up and there was nothing, no carbs.
And did you try stevia, or is it like just aspartame, those types of sweeteners?
Okay. So it's interesting with these sweeteners. Like some people can have sucralose and nothing happens. No blood sugar spike. Some people have sucralose and it's like sugar. So it's pretty individualized. There is erythritol and the xylitol. Those two are the ones that people tend to say the most are the safest for that. But then at the same time, there's research that suggests that they strip you of your gut bacteria. And so, you know, that was what we were noticing with our boys. We weren't necessarily trying to make them strict keto, but they were eating a highly ketogenic diet. And then we noticed we had all this keto junk food in the house, And like, you know, a lot of people and parents and, or people who do this for themselves, they're like, carbs are the devil. And then they're putting in all this fake crap and they're trading one thing for the other. When in reality, you can put some dang maple syrup in there and add like 2 to 3 carbs per serving, which is nothing. And at least it's real, you know? And so they're a lot of these sweeteners have their own problems, but things that trigger blood sugar, I mean, it all depends on the person, you know, like some people are very carb sensitive and some people, so they'll have, you know, beets or they'll have certain fruit and their blood sugar will go sky high. It all depends on the person's pretty much on the person's like metabolic status, basically, you know, what their history is. I think that the three things that I think are the most important are your lean body mass. How much lean body mass do you have? Your you know, insulin sensitivity. So basically, if you're someone who doesn't show signs of insulin resistance, then you will have a higher carb tolerance. You'll have a higher protein tolerance. And then lastly is your activity level. So for me, I have all three. Like I'm very insulin sensitive. I do well on every diet. I do well on low fat, high carb, high fat, low carb. And I have lots of lean mass and I'm very active. I can eat 250, 300 grams of protein in a day and still be in ketosis and not have any issues. But if you're not in that place, then what one of our favorite insulin experts down here, Dr. Benjamin Bickman, actually he's Canadian, but he did his work at over in Utah and he lives here now. He says it very, I love the way he says it because he addressed the issue of protein, because a lot of the times you see people don't eat too much protein. And then you have these people that are just a ton of people who aren't eating enough protein. Their hair's falling out. They're having all these issues. They're not well fed and they're not getting enough protein. So, you know, the first thing is obviously get your insulin sensitivity back, you know, and as you become more, you know, normalized your glucose levels, your insulin levels, then you can start to increase protein or then you can start to increase carbohydrate. But if you're still not metabolically healthy, then, you know, you're probably going to see a lot of these other things. You're not going to respond to them in a good way. I know that was kind of general. But I mean, I could tell, I mean, pretty much it all depends on the person, but there's lots of things that spike blood glucose.
Danny, you want to know something fascinating? So I'm doing my master's in nutrition and one of my colleagues, what they're doing for the research project is they're taking carbohydrate foods. I think they're doing a cup of rice, a banana, raisins, white bread. They're taking like 10 different foods that are primarily carbs. And then they're taking people from a variety of different ethnic backgrounds, giving them the carb and then testing their blood glucose every 15 minutes. And what's fascinating is that everyone responds differently. Yeah. And that's the problem, is that when Steve says, well, what food should I eat? What food should I avoid? Because that's going to spike my blood glucose. Well, it's all different. And if you think about it logically, if you give an Asian person a cup of rice and you give an Eskimo a cup of rice, their bodies are going to respond completely different, because that Asian person, they have thousands of years of ancestors living off of rice. Yep. Where that Eskimo, they were living off of seal meat, fat, right? Yeah. So it's really, really interesting. Then also your body fat percentage, your muscle insulin sensitivity changes based on if you're trained versus not trained. If you worked out that day, if you didn't work out that day, stimulants, like these are all things that play an effect.
Yeah, I totally agree, man. And that happens. You see a lot of people that, you know, for instance, people in tropical climates, they can eat a ton of fruit. They eat fruit all day and they don't have, you don't see a lot of these people with these you know, hyperinsulinemia, unless, which happens all the time. You speak of the Eskimos, like all these people, we've just infected them all with our terrible Western diet. And of course, now they're getting sick because they're having processed crap and all this crap. Yeah. And they're not
eating. Well, that's what I was going to say. The one thing we can agree, Trevor, is processed food is garbage.
Absolutely.
I think everyone, and hydrogen oil and high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah,
and totally. And artificial sweeteners like aspartame. Go ahead. Yep.
This is my number one rule. If God made it, eat it. It's not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
It comes in a box and there's 15.
Well, God made humans and God made dinosaurs. So we should eat God, dinosaurs and humans.
Dinosaurs are extinct. But honestly, I'm not promoting cannibalism, but Eating a human would be way better for you than eating a Pop-Tart.
I'm coming for you, Trev. I'm going to eat your ass, your white ass. I'm coming sure. up there.
For me to eat what I'm made of, if I'm eating the same things that my body needs, I mean, that's why like we eat. That's why we eat these animals, man. Like they got, you cut them open and they're very similar to us. That's why I eat mostly animals.
Well, there's stories where, you know, there's people who would like be on like a plane crash or things like that. And they would eat like the dead passengers.
Yeah. It happened in the Andes Mountains. Yeah. When the rugby team yeah. crashed.
And those people are perfectly yeah. fine.
And they got swole from doing that.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
When my wife was pregnant with both of our kids, man, and when she was nursing, I was having her give me as much of that breast milk as possible. I was like, give me some. When she could spare some, I would put it in my shakes. I'm not even joking. Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in that, man.
Lots of not lactoferrin. What's the word?
Lactobacillus?
No, not the probiotic. I'm thinking of an amino acid fragment that's very healthy.
Oh.
I'm going to take a bunch of steroids so I can milk myself and get gyno, and I'll drink my milk right out of my nipple. I'll get swole.
Steve, just run a bunch of a Trend and get some lactating nipples. And
sounds delicious.
Okay.
Oh, man.
So that's this is getting off topic, so we'll close off our show now. Danny, you're a super smart guy. I mean, for our listeners who are just listening to the audio, I mean, you're jacked as shit. So anyone who says you can't build muscle on keto, you can basically just flex your biceps at them. For our listeners, if someone wants to learn more about you, listen to your podcast, I'm not sure if you do one-on-one coaching, how can someone find out more about your services and more about you?
Yeah, I think the three main places is like on Instagram and Facebook, Keto Counterculture. So that's my handle. And then on the Ketogenic Athlete, if you go to the ketogenicathlete.com, we have, you know, all of our episodes are on there. And then of course, my new website that we're launching this Friday, fatfueled.family. And that is another podcast that I'm going to be doing with my wife. And that's kind of just going to be focused on, you know, fitness and nutrition with the family, peaceful parenting, mindset and unschooling, all the weird, unconventional hippie stuff that we do. So those are the main places.
Interesting. Guys, Danny is a wealth of knowledge. He's a good guy. Definitely give his social media accounts a follow. I'm going to have all those in the show notes. So don't worry about writing them down. You can just copy those from the show notes. For your host, Trevor Karitzin, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, Danny Vega. So another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life. Look good doing it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.